Ollie North is back, new president of the National Rifle Association. I'm going to have to explain to my kids who Oliver North is. If you don't think that's going to get me swearing, you have another thought coming. This has been your obscenity warning. Now we're going to get mail about what's the female equivalent of mensch.
Well, do we have a piece? It was called wench. Someone was like, the female equivalent of mensch is a wench, and I'm taking this back. And everyone was like,
love it.
Nope.
Happy Mother's Day. This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined this week by senior writer Leah Leibowitz.
Yom HaEmsameach.
And deputy editor Stephanie Butnick.
Happy 40th day of the Omer.
This week, a very unorthodox Mother's Day episode. We're going to talk about women and talk to women who don't have children or can't or won't. And, you know, we're going to talk about how that plays in the Jewish and the Catholic worlds, as it happens. Our Jew of the Week is Penina Lam Kaplansky, who's going to talk about infertility and miscarriage in the Jewish world and in Israel. And our Gentile of the Week, reaching high up onto the Gentile shelf for a serious Gentile, is Sister Julia Walsh, a Catholic sister, who's going to talk to us about, is it fair to say, renouncing fertility? Does that have a harsh
cast? Renouncing motherhood.
Renouncing mother. I wouldn't say she's renounced it. She's declined.
She's given it up for a larger purpose,
she's
arguably.
She's ascended past it.
She's married Christ, and we're going to talk to her about that. And finally, we have a terrific interview. Stephanie talked to the director of Wendy's Shabbat, a new documentary about a group of older Jews who have a regular Friday night date at Wendy's for Shabbat dinner. But let us turn to our lives. It is Mother's Day.
Always.
Mother's Day approaches.
But enough about everything else.
Enough about everything else. Liel, is there Mother's Day in Israel?
Mother's Day.
What is this Mother's Day?
Yom
Ha'ima. Yom Ha'ima.
Yeah.
Right?
Yom Ha'ima, as we say in Israeli parlance. Here's the thing about Israel. I don't want to get too macabre, but like, for very obvious reasons, it's a very child-centric society. I think the calculus being like, if you potentially are in the next 10 to 15 years going to mandatorily join an organization that may cut your life,
get you killed, right?
Somewhat shorter than you had hoped. Like, you kind of are at the center of the universe. So Mother's Day is like, yeah, nice. Here's some like a flower I picked in the garden. Father's Day is virtually completely non-existent because why even bother? And 364 days of the year are like kid day.
Kid day.
Yeah.
But don't you think about the mothers of children who have died? Like, that to me, there seems to be a real resonance there.
Oh, thanks, took a turn for the cheerful.
Thinking, because we always saying that, like, yeah, like the cemetery, isn't there like the cemetery we visited on Birthright where it's like the
yes.
young soldiers who died? And I then mean, it's like, I imagine Mother's Day is hard.
To this day.
But is Mother's Day just an American invention?
Isn't that more Yom HaZikron, right? Is that when you think about the families who have lost people?
Well, you think about this every day.
All the time.
You know, I to this day have not been, with one exception, have not been to a funeral of anyone older than me.
Wow.
That's with one exception.
Crazy.
A grandfather.
We'll try to get you an invite.
We could hold off on that.
But Mother's Day is super American. And I have to say, I'm going to go out on a super limb here. I have no evidence for this. I don't see it as particularly Jewish because I feel like, you know, the culture is more all about the kids. And I also just feel like the immigrant, three generations ago, my grandparents, I don't think my grandma was big on Mother's Day.
Okay, but I think we should always be thanking our Jewish mamas every single day.
Right.
Because if you think about just what they do for us.
And our non-Jewish mamas. And just
yeah, but,
mamas.
You know, but I'm just thinking in Jewish culture, like this idea of the Jewish mother is this like over, you know, is all sorts of stereotypes, but is in fact a loving figure.
For sure.
And supportive figure. And so I like the idea of just a day where you can say like, I appreciate you, Ma.
See, but I dislike it for the same exact reason. It seems to me like a move towards this kind of specialization of everything. It's like, well, we now have parenting experts and we're going to have a day for the mothers. Every day is Mother's
Day. Yeah, I mean, that's what my dad said. My dad says, every day is Father's Day. Don't get me anything for Father's Day. Like, we don't do Mother's Day and Father's Day gifts.
I knew you didn't.
We're not really a gift family.
I love you.
We're not either. And you know what? Like, Sid and I often, we will forget our anniversary. We'll do nothing for Mother's or Father's Day. It's just, I think it's great for people who do it, but I really do feel that, like, you know, to me, and this is totally biased, to me, like, the family that's really into Mother's Day is like the couple that never sees each other because they're both working 70-hour jobs,
right.
And the nanny raises the kids and the dog walker walks the dog, but that Sunday, oy vey, you better deliver on Mother's Day.
And then it becomes like this added pressure. What do I get for Mother's Day?
Right, and you rent the, like, cruise around Manhattan.
But I think there is a nice thing about, like, articulating your feelings in a card. You know, I just said yesterday I sent my grandma a card and hopefully it gets to Boca on time. But it's just to say, like, I love you and thank you. And, you know, like, it maybe is like a Hallmark constructed bullshit thing, but like, yeah, but I love you and I appreciate you.
We can do it every day. We should do it every
but
day.
But I think but that's a lot of cards
in fact,
to mail.
Stop right now. Call your
mother. Call your mother. That's actually our tagline.
Here's your reminder. Call your mothers. Stephanie, what's up with you?
Well, I am lolling because last night was the Met Gala and the theme and basically the exhibit what is about sort of like the fashion influences on Catholicism. And our colleague Shira Talishkanecha has a great article about this in the Washington Post. But our friend Jim Martin, our Jesuit priest Jim Martin.
Whose Catholic fashion sensibility is very strong.
Very strong.
Very strong. But so he went to the Met Gala. He was actually instrumental in getting in connecting the Met with the Met Costume Institute with like people at the Vatican to hook it up. Yeah.
So amazing.
So he tweeted things.
He looked ravishing in the black suit.
He went in his like usual outfit, which he wore to our live show and everyone could right, you know,
black
take
suit,
it in.
Understated white collar. Yep.
And so people, he tweeted, actually said to me at the hashtag Met Gala tonight, I love your costume. Is that like for real? Funky outfit. You're the best dressed dude here, bro. High fives me. You look just like the real thing. And truly, he writes, I love that you got dressed up as a sexy priest.
Oh, my God.
So James Martin putting the sexy in Society of Jesuits. Mazel tov to you.
The S in the SJ stands for sexy Jesuit.
It's like Rihanna ain't got nothing on you.
I talked about this when Jules Frakes was a guest on our show and have talked about it with her since. I think I might have talked about this with Simon Doonan. But, you know, Judaism is, you know, for all of our accomplishments, for all of our being welcome to the club, to the country club, to the university club, to the neighborhood, nobody really ever thinks that Judaism is sexy in a runway sense. It's kind of played as kitschy. I mean, my point has always been there have been vogues for very African looking women. There have been vogues for very Asian and South Asian looking women. You've never seen the runway show where it's like frizzy haired women with big Jewish noses.
But see, if it was a Met Gala.
We never get really treated as sexually desirable in that way.
But I don't even care about that. I'm talking about clothes. Like if we did a Met Gala about Jewish like fashion influences, it would literally be preppy clothes because of Ralph Lauren and like all these. It would be all the shit that we gave the going. Yeah, like the making of Americana Jewish immigrants, and I would just wear full schmattas.
Well, that would be. But head see, to that's, toe. That's the th- right. So there is the show that should which the Met should do, which is like how Jacoby Press and Ralph Lauren, all these people gave us wasp wear. But the other show really would be like, can we do something sexy with, you know, women in shadels and those stockings that are completely opaque and long skirt, and nobody will ever try it. And I think something is missing there. I think that like we say, oh, Catholic Church, sexy, you know, and Jews just won't get that love.
But we also don't have like the liturgical garb that the Catholic Church has. Like we don't got those robes and like the headdresses.
That's
pretty
true. Fair enough.
We kept it simple.
Yeah.
We kept it simple.
But we do beards.
Well, yeah, it would be beards. It would be talitot. It would be talesim. Like just like it would be the all talis fashion.
I'll walk in wearing my tefillin.
Yeah,
it'd be great.
So speaking of tefillin,
yes.
This morning I wake up because I stayed over last night. Shay Leibowitz. I woke up and emerged, rubbing the sleep out of my eyes to see Liel wrapping up in his tefillin, and I thought,
do you think he was
this is the way to begin a morning.
Was he just doing it because you were there?
Unclear.
Also, you guys had a sleepover last night?
We had a sleepover last night, yeah.
Just like every night. Yep. Yes, we did.
Last night, I realized I don't want to get up at 5 tomorrow morning. So I drove in last night, parked in the garage in your building, go upstairs. Lisa's flopped out on the sofa. She's fallen asleep reading something. And Liel's sitting there in his throne reading. And he says, what are you drinking? And he gets me, I say, gin. And he brings me something. It's blue gin. What is it? It's like gin plus absinthe plus ayahuasca.
It's just a new brand of Canadian. Hold on, let's
it's called a Monday
properly.
Night.
I have
it's
never so been good. As drunk on half an ounce of liquor as I was on that thing. So then I pass out and have weird dreams all night, wake up in the morning and emerge to see Liel wrapping up, 6'5", Liel wrapping up into tefillin in his boxer shorts. And I really think I've gone crazy. I think that actually I've died and gone to some sort of special like Jew land in another dimension.
Yeah, like what was in that gin?
I've passed through the wrinkle in time.
The gin is called Empress 1908 Gin. It's Canadian and made out of some sort of, I don't know, some sort of blue wild flower. It's bright blue.
It is very potent.
Will you send me a bottle of that?
I will send
you. I'd like to request a present.
I'll send you a bottle.
Because the news of the Jews is I have never been as drunk as I was on half an ounce of that stuff last night.
Inshallah.
You guys should have done a recording segment.
We do.
Meanwhile, I emptied, I think, half a bottle of scotch while you were sipping on that little.
Delicately sipping.
Oh.
Well, I'm glad you guys had fun.
Yeah, we had fun. Next.
Sorry,
next,
not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. News of the Jews. Liel, what you got?
I have the mother load.
The mother load.
By the way, I like that it's like a complete competition now.
Yeah.
Who can Stephanie. Bring the best story?
Yeah.
If you were hosting the Prime Minister of Japan and his lovely wife over for dinner, what might you serve for dessert?
Ooh, maybe like a mochi, like a green tea ice cream
like
that I ate myself in Japan.
And not to be too like detail oriented, but how would you serve it?
I think I'm like a very spare, based on my eating experiences in Japan where I went on my honeymoon, a very spare.
Like a nice little white plate,
like a
with
plate,
a good arrangement.
Or like maybe like a bamboo tray, something sort of very simple. I would say nothing too ornate, nothing too offensive.
And so, you obviously would not do very well as the Prime Minister of Israel, who this week, the beloved Benjamin Netanyahu, served Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and his wife dessert, which was lovely chocolate laced with gold and seaweed, served inside a shoe.
Sorry, what now?
They served shoes to the table. Now, in their defense, it was not actual shoes, which actually would have been kind of cool. It was like a really expensive iron cast sculpture of a men's dress wingtip brogue. And yet, here's the question.
I thought it was a chocolate shoe.
It is. No, the shoe is cast iron. And inside
picture.
It was the chocolate.
Sorry.
Now, this begs the question, why?
Mazel.
Why would you ever do that?
Now,
it was amazing.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
In the Instagram, the Prime Minister of Japan is smiling. The smile is like, I would like to be on a plane
I've
now.
I've seen some shit in my day, but nothing like that.
These Jews are whack.
This civilization
These
is.
These Jews are whack. And Japan already has some funny ideas about the Jews. So correct me if I'm wrong, but Japan shoes, you don't put shoes, you don't even wear shoes inside.
Correct.
So to put them on a table.
By the way, you know who knows that about Japan?
Everybody.
Every single person
so,
alive.
Okay, so the chef, it was like a famous chef that they pulled in for this meal, right?
It was like the guy Fieri.
So did he have an excuse? I mean, when...
Very creative. What, you want to serve the boring dessert in the plate with the hummus?
But it's like, it's good. Really, it's just offensive, right? Because it's like, here's this thing that you guys have said doesn't even belong in your house,
yes,
right? Like,
is.
You take it off when you get home, you put on like a nice little slipper.
In what culture is this appetizing?
The only way this works for me is if the shoe is chocolate. Like, if it's chocolate, fine.
But
you can put it.
That's still, to
it's
me,
still
it's
weird.
Just so
then
not what someone who is Japanese would want
right.
and would find.
But they were screening the Charlie Chaplin movie of like him eating the shoe. Look, his shoe is very edible, very delicious.
Well, look, I mean, if the chef gets kicked out of Israel, he can always move to Chicago, where in News of the Jews this week, an Israeli was thrown out of an Uber cab for being Israeli. This is an amazing story. From Tablet's Chicago correspondent, Gretchen Rachel Hammond. I'll just read her piece that she wrote for Tablet. Yesterday afternoon, Itai Milner, Israel's deputy consul general in Chicago, left his office and decided to take an Uber home. I was just sitting in the back seat, he told Tablet. We'd been driving for about 10 minutes. We were on Lower Wacker Drive when I received a call from a colleague. When I picked up the phone, I answered in Hebrew. According to Milner, the driver immediately stopped the car and started yelling at him. He was saying, "Get out of my car," Milner said. He was using the F word. I didn't understand what was going on. I asked him what was wrong. He didn't say anything, just repeated, "Get out of my car." Milner asked if the problem was that he was speaking Hebrew. The driver said yes, Milner recalled. Even though I was in the middle of the highway, I decided it was better to get out of the car. He ended up walking the rest of the way home, but not before taking a picture of the driver, who was in a 2017 Toyota Camry. According to the Uber app, the driver has been working for the company for 1 year and has a 4.89 rating.
I was about to say, that driver's rating is 5 stars of David.
This just put me in mind of the great scene from Stripes where Bill Murray... You've seen Stripes?
No.
You've seen Stripes, right, Liel?
Oh, of course.
Of course, where Bill Murray... It's a little bit different because Bill Murray throws the woman out of his cab on the bridge, right? He says, "I don't want you in my cab." He pulls over, takes her suitcases out, just puts them at the side of the road. This is poor Itai Milner, deputy general consul in Chicago, who gets thrown out of the cab...
And the cab driver then just like uses Waze to get home from there.
All I can say is
like, those Jews, they control everything. Waze, what is shortest way to Midtown?
All I can say is Lyft, anyone?
Yeah, I actually am pro Lyft. My sister-in-law works at Lyft. I'm Lyft, not Uber. So yeah, that's what I
mean. Considering like the kind of overall etiquette of cab drivers, especially like in this city, to be thrown out of a cab is really it's really a new level.
A new low. Top that, Stephanie Butnick.
Okay, so you know how like when I write congrats on your Facebook wall, it kind of like animates with like little confettis falling?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you've like been a Jewish user of social media and you like want to wish someone mazel tov, you wouldn't get that same effect until now.
Oh.
Because Facebook, I guess in an effort to something, I don't know.
To maybe now, make us forget about, you know, rigging the election.
In an effort to placate Jews.
Taking our privacy away.
Has added like mazel tov to the list of words that like sort of like spark an animation.
What's the animation? Is like guys in a Russian Fiddler on the Roof tradition dance, like with their arms around each
yeah,
other.
Yeah, like payuses just fall down.
Bottles on
of
their
confetti.
Head, yeah.
But, you know, as our super intern...
By the way, that was so funny. Hey, there's just you wrote mazel tov, and there's a huge picture of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson.
And just covers the screen.
The Rebbe concurs.
But, you know, we have our wonder intern, Theo Kantor, and he wrote that basically, like, his friends were like, what? Like, too late for us. You know, like, the people who, like, you'd think would be really excited about this, the teens, are like, meh.
Well, the teens are post-Facebook, right? It's all Instagram
these
days.
I mean,
this
is really like for your aunt who uses Facebook.
Right.
Right, but here's the thing. If it is for your aunt who uses Facebook, then mazel tov is like really just a gateway drug. Then you should go like full in. You should do like whenever you write like, I'm so verklempt, like there'll be just an illustration of someone going like, be like, oh, all these tourists. And then just the screen will turn black. Like you should really go... full Yiddish.
You should see like a big scoop of hummus just hit the screen.
But I feel like instead of like Kimojis, which are like the Kim Kardashian emojis, we should have like Gilda Radner emojis that just
or
like
Shlomojis. The Shlomo emojis. The International Consortium of Internet or whatever you're called. If you're listening, we would like some Shlomojis.
Shlomojis.
Yeah, like give us some real serious Yiddish stuff. So I recently saw a movie that I loved so much. It's called Wendy Shabbat.
How great is that movie?
It was, oh my God, it's so fantastic. Sweet. It's basically the story of a group of elderly Jews who live in Palm Desert out in California. And each Friday night for a few years now, they have been meeting at the local Wendy's, the fast food restaurant.
Kehilat Kedosha Beit Baconator.
And yeah, they just eat, have a nice meal there. And it's so sweet. The people who work at Wendy's love it. They set up the table. They put a reserve sign. And these people, you know, they bring their like electronic Shabbat candles. And so I had the pleasure of sitting down with Rachel Myers, who directed the film. And her grandmother, Roberta, is one of the stars of the film. Actually, Rachel's mother produced the film. So it was like a real family affair. So the movie just premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival a few weeks ago. And so Rachel and Roberta were in town. And I sat down with them. And here is our interview. So why Wendy's? How did this start?
Well, there was a couple that, as if you saw in the film, Sharon Goodman, she and her husband and another friend went one Friday night. They had nothing to do, and they decided they're going to go to Wendy's. And, of course, the husband said, Wendy's? I mean, they couldn't imagine. So they went to Wendy's and they asked the manager if they could come. And the manager said yes. And this is how it started.
But come bearing candles and challah.
Yeah,
and
they
wine.
Had challah.
I mean, not wine.
Not just wine. Not real. The battery operated candles because we, you know, the fire hazard. So and that's how it started. And today we can get on, depending on the Friday and the time of year, we can get like 20 people or we can have 28 or 30. Maybe sometimes we've had since this video has been out there, we've had as many as 40 people show up at Wendy's. And it's just a hoot. It really is. But it's so nice because even if they're strangers, they're welcomed. And it's a very warm feeling to go.
Yeah, she called me the week after it happened that it went viral because we had 200,000 hits online, and she said it was standing room only at Wendy's tonight.
And one of my favorite things is actually the employees at Wendy's who now know to expect you guys and love you guys so much.
Yeah, and then, you know, somebody brings dessert, and if we have extra dessert, we just give it to the kids in the back. And they're appreciative, and they really go out of their way for us. So it's been fun.
Yeah, they set up the tables and put a little reserve sign.
I know, it's so beautiful.
We had some woman come, a group of people came. They're from Vancouver. Last Friday. We walk in and there's white tablecloths and flowers. Some of these people that have been coming, they just set the table with flowers and tablecloths. It was just so nice, so sweet.
I mean, I think there is something really about the scene of you guys there together that really resonates with people. I think one of the employees in the film says it reminds him of his grandparents. I mean, it just is this really feel-good story about a group of people coming together.
I felt like it was a great way to show a window into this community, a positive portrayal of active senior life that isn't seniors who are sick or struggling with you know, the challenge in our film is really the film navigates the line about between growing older and seeing people you care about and love as friends pass away and partners, and then finding community in later life.
Yes. We had a couple of people that lost their spouses, and they're back at Wendy's. They come. They're just part of. If you've ever heard of the word Havara, which is a group, it's family. It's become like a Havara.
Yeah, it's been very sad because in the last year since we filmed the movie, four members of the group have passed away.
And Rabbi
Isaiah Zeldin, who was a really prolific rabbi, was one of those people who we lost, and a good friend of Nana's.
Was a friend.
So, you know, that side of the mortality of the group is an interesting part of the conversation.
Yeah, but you keep going, and we talk about people that have passed, but you know what? They're all still with us. They're still part of the group.
And I think there's a really important and amazing message about ritual and spirituality that you could make this place sacred. A Wendy's that serves cheeseburgers and bacon whatevers is actually a sacred place for you guys.
Yeah, it is. And it could, as Rachel said, it could have been anywhere, but the being as convenient as it is, and they've been so wonderful to us.
And it's affordable.
And
no one has to clean up.
Yeah, there's the $4. There's the
we come in for $4. You get a hamburger, fries, nuggets, and a drink. As Rabbi Zeldin said, it's a good deal. It's a great deal.
So, is it true that there are other Wendy's Shabbat groups that are forming?
Yeah, we only have been receiving emails and like follow-up photos, so I don't know the extent beyond what we're hearing from them, but we were asked by a few groups if they were able to use the name Wendy's Shabbat, like if we would give them permission to form their own group. So we know that there was a group that had a Wendy's Shabbat in Boca, and Toronto got an email, and we got and some photos from a group in Tennessee who took pictures at a Mexican restaurant, and they brought a challah and wine, and they said it was Wendy's Shabbat with margaritas.
Yeah.
Ooh, that sounds fun.
that's fun. It does.
Yeah. I mean, years ago, I was in Israel over the summer, and like I was on a beach with a bonfire on a Friday night, and that was Shabbat, and I felt it was a little enviable that in Israel, like, you can just be Jewish and Shabbat is Shabbat. And in for American Jews, it's kind of like you have to go do something. And so what I love about Wendy's Shabbat is it's like it really doesn't require much.
It's not about where you go, what you eat. It's being together with a group that are friends, and that it's a warm, wonderful feeling. So I say, it as Rachel said, it could be a bonfire down at a beach, or at a Wendy's. That's the way I feel about it. And I was brought up originally in a very Orthodox home. And Friday night you were all there, and you sat down at the table for Shabbat, and that was the way it was.
I love this. This is, I mean, this is such, it's such a beautiful story, and it's so nice that you guys are here together. I mean, and you're, it's a real family affair because your mother produced the film,
right?
Yeah,
my mom is a retired elementary school teacher and principal and, you know, has never produced anything. Well, that's not entirely true. She did produce a very ambitious production of The Wizard of Oz when she was an elementary
school. Principal, yeah, she was in elementary school. Yeah.
She produced a production of The Wizard of Oz with like 500 kids. Years ago, but and we've always been a sort of theatrically oriented family, but she's never produced a film. And I basically said, Mom, Nana's in this and I'm directing it. And she just rose to the challenge, and she's done a fantastic job, like handling all the, you know, correspondence and scheduling and festivals, and she built the website. And so she's a producer.
Very talented. Very talented family. See, what can
it's
I
like,
tell
look at
you?
These amazing women that I come from. And I will also say, I mean, it was really interesting to work together, like three generations of women in the family, to have that kind of relationship with my mom, because we've never had a sort of business administrative relationship, and it went so smoothly, and it felt like the strength of our personal relationship just made the professional, you know, business affairs really easy. And you've been a wonderful talent. She didn't know she was going to be a star at 88. And
could you believe?
I can believe it. You're a star.
And then I will also say that I made the project with a group of female filmmakers. It was all women, from my cinematographer, John Tyson, my amazing editor, Dana Turkin, who really helped me shape the voice of the whole thing, and Juliana Schatz, the field producer. So it was just like a, you know, love all around.
Yes. It was fun. It really was. When she first presented the idea, I said, oh, well, okay. Why not? But never in wildest dreams could you ever imagine anything like this. I'm just so proud of her. I think she's phenomenal. Oh, she's just a great person and a great talent.
Well, I get it from you.
Oh,
no, it was, you know, we've always had a really good, close relationship. And, oh God, you're going to make me cry.
Oh, boy, don't do that.
No, but we've always had a really close relationship. And it was interesting as a filmmaker, because I wanted to be honest in the portrayal of her, but I also, you know, wanted to show things that are somewhat uncomfortable. Like we shot her like lying in bed or sleeping or things, you know, that really show the vulnerability of being on your own. And it's been really challenging, like since my grandpa passed away, because they were together their whole lives. And so I really had a hard time navigating that a little bit. And in some of the questions too, you know, we ask questions of you that really
were very personal.
And I, you know, you and I have talked like that privately, but for you to speak like that in front of a camera crew and to put it on film, I mean, that really was powerful.
To ask me how I met your grandfather, that was interesting.
So,
but I was honest.
Yeah, and some other things which didn't make it into the film, but it was really tender, and I'm really glad that we could share this. It was really special.
Yeah. Now your kids can always know what your grandmother was like.
Oh, stop. You're going to be around forever.
Oh, well, I hope to be.
She's very active between like mahjong and cardiac exercise class and walking in the pool.
I walk in the pool. I try to every day, but that gets away from me sometimes. But I do go in the water, try and walk at least an hour every day.
Well, thank you so much, director Rachel Myers, movie star Roberta Mahler, WendyShabbat.com.
Thank you.
Good luck with everything.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
Stay when calling a name that's like
Mother's Day, and we talk a lot about mothers and daughters and sons and things like that. But what we don't talk about often is the journey to motherhood and the often difficult time people have having babies. And we thought it would be interesting to look at this from the Jewish perspective, in a community where, you know, like, be fruitful and multiply is what we are told to do. So we're here on the phone with Penina Lam Kaplansky, who's calling us from Modin in Israel, where she lives after moving from New York with her family in 2011. And we wanted to talk to Penina because she wrote a really great article in the Times of Israel. It was called Thoughts from a Member of the Miscarriage Club, in which she was really, really candid about the experience of having a miscarriage sort of far along in her pregnancy and what happened in the Jewish community and the resources she was and wasn't able to find. Hi, Penina.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So in the piece you write, I began to wonder why so few people ever talk about it in our Jewish community. I would have loved to read some articles about how women cope from a Jewish perspective. It seems like you found out only through this experience that so many other women that you knew and didn't know had had a similar experience. You called it a club you don't want to join.
Yeah, exactly. So I think kind of, you know, in our, at the time, you know, it was my first experience with it, obviously, because it was my first pregnancy. It was my, you know, it was my first and hopefully my only loss. So I didn't really know anybody who had gone through it. After I wrote this article, I got about 200 emails from all sorts of people who had gone through similar experiences, whether it be people, you know, my age in their early 20s with their first child, you know, people in their 40s with their seventh child that they lost, people who had miscarriages 30, 40, 50 years ago. So I kind of really felt like it gave people an opportunity to have somebody to talk to. I have been, you know, surprised and I guess happy to see that there have been a lot of changes since I've gone through that experience, or maybe I've just been exposed to things that I didn't know about before. Like there is an organization that I've heard of called Yesh Tikva, which helps women in the Jewish community and gives them support if they're going through infertility or pregnancy loss issues. So they run a really fabulous program called the, I think it's called the Shabbat All Over the World. And what they do is they encourage rabbis or teachers or women in various communities all over the world to dedicate one Shabbat before Pesach to talking about infertility or pregnancy loss in front of the whole community. So this past year, well, the past 2 years, we've done it in our shul, Derchei Tzion, in Modin. And it's been really great in terms of just inspiring conversation and kind of bringing, you know, awareness to the fore just in terms of the fact that we as a Jewish community, we as a community in general, need to be there for each other, not only when there are happy things like going to a brit or going to a wedding or things like that, but also when things just are really hard. And just to be more open about that and kind of give advice to people about, you know, how to handle it when your friends are going through it, when you're going through it and things like that. I just like it sparked a really nice conversation.
Speaking of advice, is there any piece of advice that having gone through what you went through, you would want to hear right now that you think someone in that condition really could take to heart?
It's interesting. I think I more have advice for people who have friends who are going through it, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's important too.
I would say the first thing is that, you know, we have a tendency to be nervous about asking people about hard things. You know, after somebody who has a close relative who passed away, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to bring it up. You don't want to make them upset and stuff like that. So I guess I just have news for people, which is that when you've gone through a big loss, like a stillbirth or are going through infertility, oftentimes it's something that you really can't get off your mind. Obviously everybody's different. But I think in general, people who are going through things like this want to be asked how they're doing. And once you do ask somebody how they're doing, just be there to listen to them and show them that they're not a burden because they have problems. So I think that's the first thing, to just ask and to listen. The second thing, I would say is also just be mindful of what you're sharing on social media. I think that, you know, we obviously kind of tend to put our perfect lives forward on social media, and the person on the other end, your friend who doesn't have a child or who doesn't have a spouse or who doesn't, you know, who doesn't have that perfect life, it's sometimes hurtful to them. So just to be mindful of that.
Penina, give me an insight into modern Orthodox world on this. You know, my world is not as observant as yours. And, you know, in my world, if you have 0, 1, 2, 3 kids, you know, it's when you get over 4 kids or over 3 that people start talking, right? You know, in your world, in Israel, the norm is 4 or 5 kids, broadly mm-hmm. speaking. Is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
So,
it's a range, but
be totally candid with me. You know, how do people whisper behind people's backs? Do people think, if you're in a modern Orthodox community, do people think 8 is crazy? And conversely, do people, if you only have 0 or 1 or 2, do people feel pity? Do they feel a little bit of scorn, like you're not doing the job? I mean, what's the kind of chatter that goes on in the community based on how many kids you're having?
Well, I like to think that people aren't so judgmental. I do think, though, that as you know, I really think that as issues like infertility, miscarriages, but also things like mental illness and stuff like that become more of a conversation, and I really do think they're becoming more of a conversation, people aren't talking and behind people's backs and saying, oh, they only have 2 kids. Like, oh, maybe they're like not as observant as we think they are, maybe. But I think they'll tend towards a more sensitive approach of, you know, either this isn't where they're at and they're not trying to have more, or, you know, maybe they're going through something and that's really hard. Let's try and be there for them. I really do think that's where my community at least is headed, and I can speak to my community. Although on the other hand, I do think that like as a person who lives in a more homogeneous community of people who are in their, you know, who are in their 20s and early 30s and who are all basically married and in childbearing age, like obviously there is this pressure. There are like 20 women in my community who are pregnant right now. So, you know, obviously there's this pressure to have children. And when you don't, and you do feel like you're kind of excluded from the community, whether that's purposeful from the side of the community or not, you kind of are excluded in that sense.
Right. I mean, when the socializing is at the playground or at drop off at the nursery school, you know, it's hard to escape that. The other question I had is, you talked a second ago about social media and you have to be careful what you put out there. I sometimes feel like social media there's only a downside, right? It just makes people feel bad. And there's research on this too, that people tend to look at other people's lives on social media, these perfectly curated lives, and then just feel bad about themselves. I mean, is there an upside? It seems to me if you're going through something like this, I could imagine that what you want is to be loved by close friends and family whom you've talked to, and then to, you know, not have to deal with the perfectly curated Facebook feeds of the rest of the world. Is there any argument for social media if you've gone through miscarriage or stillbirth or infertility?
I think there are 2 types of personalities, first of all. I think there's the types of personalities that just get very sad and can't look at anything. That was kind of my type of personality. And then there's like my husband's type of personality, which is like, we need to be happy for everybody. It's so great. So there's definitely 2 types of personalities there, but I also do think that,
by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt, but how did that play out when you were going through, you know, what you were going through? Were there moments in which you just looked and be like, why are you so, you know, benevolent and open right now? Why aren't you mourning with me?
Yeah, I guess there were times like that. It's definitely, you know, stillbirth, miscarriage, infertility, you know, causes you to think about a lot of different things in your relationships that you didn't think about before. So it's definitely, like every transition in life, it's kind of a work in progress to reestablish your relationships and stuff like that. But I do think that just for the positive side of social media is that you can, you know, how did I get the word out about the article that I wrote, which got responses from so many people? It was by sharing it on social media. So I think that, you know, and also the other thing is that I think it's nice to share things on social media. If you have, you know, a new baby, that's so beautiful to share it with your friends and family. But on the other side, you have to balance it with sensitivity. So, you know, the way I kind of view it is, if you're going to post something about your kid, also post an article about that, like, reaches out to somebody who, you know, or that will speak to somebody who's going through something that's hard. So, like, I really do try, when I see an article that speaks to me in terms of what I've gone through with infertility and miscarriage, I like to post it, because that's kind of a way of signaling to people, you know, there are really great things that are happening here to all of your friends. And, you know, either you might be sad or it might make you happy, but there are also people out there who are remembering what you're going through, can identify with what you're going through, and who can empathize with what you're going through.
And we know you have to go because you have to pick up your daughter from daycare, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, so I did have a happy ending.
So I'm curious how your experience has, you know, you're talking about when you post pictures of your beautiful child, which I'm sure you do. I mean, how does this experience how has it sort of changed you, and now, especially now that you have a child?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, I think after I had my daughter, it took me a long time to allow myself to, like, be in that kind of place where I was like, yeah, I'm a mother, because for so long I had been a person who was either, you know, upset or, you know, sometimes jealous or, you know, felt hurt and stuff like that. And so, like, it took me a long time to transition from that to, you know, all of a sudden being happy. I finally, you know, we finally got what we wanted. So that was like kind of a hard, like an interesting transition. But of course I really, you know, like it continues to be an issue that I, you know, really, really care about. So I continue to run this Yish Tikva, awareness Shabbat and Urshul. But I also, you know, I just try to be as sensitive as possible. I really don't post pictures actually on social media. You know, I think it's something that I think anybody who goes through this kind of situation can say that it changes them forever, just in terms of, you know, what, you know, watching their words and making sure to not say something insensitive. Obviously we all slip up sometimes, but I think, you know, it kind of guides me in terms of how I, you know, interact with people and how I, you know, interact with my technology and how I interact with my community. Yeah.
Well, Penina Lamb-Kaplansky, thank you so much for being our Jew of the Week. This has been
a
moving and extraordinary conversation. I encourage everyone to go to the Times of Israel and look at your wonderful piece, Thoughts from a Member of the Miscarriage Club, and tell us the website of the organization you run.
It's HereNextYearIsrael.com.
HereNextYearIsrael.com for people looking at at time in the IDF, right?
IDF, Sheirut Lumi, or University in Israel.
Excellent. All right. Go pick up your daughter. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Penina.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Bye.
What a great interview. I just want to say what she said is totally true, which is when you have a miscarriage, you discover everybody's had miscarriages. I think we had 3 or 4. I can't even remember. And people see you and they think, you have a lot of kids, fertility must be easy. And fertility is not easy. And what's more, we had a miscarriage between child 4 and child, well, God willing, child 5. But after 4 children, a year or so ago, we had a miscarriage. And they just keep coming. It's like, it's this endless, I mean, we're it so happens that like, I think Sid's temperament about these things, especially when you've had a very successful first pregnancy, we got pregnant very easily the first time and that was, you know, and right. And ended up with a totally easy picture book pregnancy. So you sort of feel like, okay, we can do this. Whereas I think people who have a couple or 3 miscarriages before the first child, it's this panic. Like, will I be able to have a child if that's what you want, right? And so I think we never had that panic. But I think there was a miscarriage between Rebecca and Ellie. I can't even remember where the second or third was. I mean, it's like, it's a fog of like, will this work? And there are people who have 9 kids but have had 20 pregnancies.
I also think there's a way in which, and maybe it's I'm associating it with the Jewish community because it's what I'm part of, but there's like a, oh, when are you going to have kids? When are you going to have kids? And that's actually a really insensitive thing to say in a lot of cases, right? Like I feel like I'm not trying to have kids right now, but there's a way in which I think, especially once you're married, there's people look at you and they're expecting something and you have no idea what someone's going through. And I think that there's this community, it's sort of like Soon by You, that web series where it's like, oh, Soon by You, soon you'll be engaged. I can't even imagine in a community where everyone has a bunch of kids.
Right.
First of all, I mean, a decision to have fewer kids just because of, you know, the difficulties of modern life, right? I don't know. I just think we should all be a little bit more sensitive to that stuff.
And I think, you know, I give enormous credit to my friends who I know have struggled with fertility. By the way, the same thing is true for people who want to be partnered in life, which not everyone does, but people who do want to be partnered who haven't found a partner yet, which is, you know, as we go on in life, or people who want to make partner at the firm. I mean, those are the people who have aspects of good fortune that they're hoping for that they don't have yet, who are surrounded by people who have them. That puts enormous strains on friendships and relationships. And I give enormous credit to the people I know who are struggling with fertility or have had, you know, painful experiences, who really do summon, like, who genuinely feel cheer and goodwill for people who seem to, like, just have one, you know, bit of good luck after the next with things like childbearing or relationships. And I think, I mean, what are you going to do when you're having, you know, a 4th or 5th child? You're not going to not tell people, right? And so on the other hand, like, it has to be painful for certain people to see that happen. I mean, right. I know one feels this around weddings too, which is like, you know, you worry about
good for you,
good for you.
I'm so happy for you.
You worry about the single friend, but you don't want to be like pitying the person because, of course, you know, you want to assume that their lives are terrific and rich, which they are, and it's all very it's so complicated.
But it is interesting. It's also complicated. I'm sure people look at your family and are like, oh, 4th. And a 5th on the way, like, look at, like, lucky, you know, those. But it actually is not like that at all, right? Yeah. Like,
now you're just gloating, Oppenheimer.
You know.
The 5th kid is just a Well, F you, kid, to the rest of us.
I mean, I always make this point about money as well, which is sometimes people assume that, like, the family that has a big income, which, by the way, this is not a problem we have, but I try to remember when I see people who I know have very big incomes, I also don't know how many deadbeat relatives they're supporting or how many elderly relatives are in very expensive end-of-life care. You just don't know what's going on with other people.
So what do? We are sensitive, but
you're
also—
You're just nice to people.
You're just a
decent, kind, thoughtful human being. Solves all problems right away.
That's right. And try to remember that you're not—
Inshallah, bless Moses
and remember that
Moses
you're not
and Jesus.
The center of the universe. And I want to say, I think if there's one like specific bit of advice that she had, she said, do ask people how they're doing.
I think,
I will say, err on the side of asking people. Like, for every 1 out of 10 people who will say that's really private and be kind of snippy about it,
nine people will be so grateful that you were so much. Of course.
Ask people.
I think when you know something bad has happened to someone, you almost don't want to ask them about it, but it's like, no, we should.
Somebody who's lost someone, I try to, 6 months or a year out, I say, how are you doing about that loss? And I've never had someone be anything but grateful. You know, sometimes they'll say, I don't want to talk about it. Thank you so much for asking. You know, just be, push into people's lives a little bit.
Just be a person.
Our Gentile of the Week is like a serious, serious Gentile.
Big Gentile.
Very, very into it. Sister Julia Walsh, she's a Franciscan Sister of Perpetual Adoration.
That is so Gentile.
She is a Catholic youth minister and a committed social justice activist, and she is on staff at Marywood Franciscan Spirituality Center in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Sister Julia.
Hello.
Sister Julia.
I want to say shalom to you all because sometimes I say that to my friends and they think I'm nuts.
This is the place.
This is a safe space. You could say whatever shalom you want.
Right. Up there in northern Wisconsin, they don't speak shalom, do they?
Yeah, I don't know any Jews around here. Sorry.
Now, I'm hearing a lilt of northern Wisconsin in your voice. Are you from the deep north originally?
Actually, I'm from Iowa. I grew up in Iowa. But yeah, so I'm pretty Midwest.
You're pretty Midwest. Yeah. I got it. So listen, thank you so much for being our Gentile of the Week. Welcome to our very Jewish podcast. We've heard wonderful things about you. We're so excited to have you here. This is our, as it happens.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. It's a true honor. I can't even tell you how exciting this is.
By the way, the Gentiles are so much nicer when they come on the show.
I know.
Like, you're thanking us.
The Jews are just being like, yeah, that's okay. Whatever. Ask me questions.
What are you feeding me? So this is our Mother's Day episode. So, of course, we thought we'll get on someone who has promised that for this life, at least, she's not going to have children. We thought you would just be the perfect guest. So we're going to get to that in a second. But first of all, could you sum up for us, how do you end up a Franciscan Sister of Perpetual Adoration? What took you here? When did you figure out this was your calling?
Yeah, maybe I'm still trying to figure that out, actually. Here I am 12 years into the life and still not sure, yet committed. So, right? Isn't that the way a relationship with God works?
Is it
just kind of like bowing to the mystery over and over? And
it's like you've got to renew your vows every few years. You go to Vegas and say, God, still with you.
It's perpetual perplexion is what it is. Like, I am doing this. I don't fully know why. That's how I feel.
Yeah, right? Here I am. We had a celebration here at the Spirituality Center a week ago for sisters in this diocese. I don't know if that's such a Catholic word, but, you know, this region of the church. The bishop came, and there were all these older sisters who were renewing their vows for 50 or more years. And then I was there for like, oh, it's my ninth year of vows. Yay.
You felt like such a piker. This is like Scientology where you sign a billion-year contract.
Right? Yeah. It's just like Scientology.
Just like Scientology. Okay, so you've been in for 12 years. You know, tell us how you got in.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I guess, I mean, it's really actually a very long, complicated process. And I didn't really know that getting into it. I didn't know any nuns or sisters growing up, and only was exposed to the life through Sister Act and Sound of Music. And so, like, that was my narrow understanding of what it was. And then
Whoopi Goldberg got you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, she made it look so fun, even though she wasn't real. She was undercover. So, I guess when I was like 17 or something, I had a prayer experience where I heard be a nun over in my head, like as if it were a song that I couldn't get out of my head. And I just was terrified and tried to avoid it, but yet wanted to be faithful. So I sent in a card for some information, and that got me on some mailing lists. And then through college, I started visiting convents and meeting with a spiritual director and praying and just kind of trying to really understand what it was all about.
Did you do a nun run?
Oh, no. Actually, I don't even know if they existed because this would have been like the early 2000s. And I feel like that started happening in, the 2010s or so.
What's a nun run?
Do you want to tell them, Sister Julia, what a nun run is?
Yeah. They're so, they look really amazing. Basically, it's like a bar crawl, but it's from convent to convent, like in a day where you check out each one really quick.
And it's women at Catholic colleges will often do them like on spring break. They'll do a week where they'll just hop on a bus and do a nun run and like check out possible convent options.
Exactly. Yeah. So, no, I didn't have that opportunity. I feel like since I was discerning, back in the day, it was, there's been a lot more. There's just been an increase of like things that are available for sisters, for women who are thinking about becoming sisters or nuns. So it was really confusing when I did it. Yeah.
I'm still curious. So here you are one day in college and you're living a collegiate lifestyle, you know, more or less, wild.
You know, not actually.
Right. No, but I'm saying it's still
more
like
or less.
a secular, let me rephrase this. One day you're in college, you're living the collegiate lifestyle. It's totally, you know, secular. And then the next day you are in a totally different environment. What was it like walking into a convent for the first time?
The first time I went was actually, I think it was at the end of my freshman year of college. I went and visited a convent. And I remember having the same sort of giddiness that I did when I went to prom. Like where I was just like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. And this could change my life forever in the same sort of way that I might have about some of the guys that I just sat on the couch and held hands with, you know? So it wasn't like,
you had a much better prom than I did, I have to say.
Yeah. Or I was just a really goody two shoes, you know, I was a really good Christian girl. But,
so how did you decide on the, because I'm going to speak Catholic now for a moment. Like what was it about the charism of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration that made you say, this is for me? As opposed to the Dominicans or the Sisters of St. Joseph or one of the others?
So actually, at the end of college was when I kind of came out to my friends and said, hey, everyone, I think I'm going to be a nun. And they're like, yeah, we know. Okay. And so then they were all...
Who'd you think you were kidding? We totally knew.
Right. And they I was at a Catholic college at the time, and so there was like this culture there. And so then everyone was kind of suggesting communities. And my best friend at the time, he had happened to have visited my current community's convent like a few months prior. And so he's like, oh, I know the community for you. And then he described them as like, oh, they're really respectful of tradition and they have great devotion and great prayer life, but they're also very modern and they're interested in social justice and they're academic and they're artistic. And I was like, oh yeah, that sounds like everything I want to be. Sounds great. You know? And, so right after I graduated from college, I went and visited for a week. And, by the end of the week, I just was like, yeah, this is going to be who I enter. But it was only, I guess, 22, 23 or something. So I kind of thought, well, but I'm going to enjoy my 20s first. I'm going to try to be normal and blend in. And I'll do this when I'm 30, when I'm all grown up. But yeah, you can't really procrastinate on God's, like, what God has
done. No, when he calls, he calls. No. How did your parents take it?
Let's see. My mom was a convert from Lutheran to Catholic. So she, I think my observation was that she really struggled with, like, kind of giving up her dreams for me. She always expected that I was going to be a wife and a mother and, you know, being a teacher and just kind of living this traditional life that she had heard me talk about fairly, you know, for years. So that was a fair assumption I think she was, it was definitely a curveball for her. My dad, on the other hand, was, so excited and he was a hospice nurse and he started like asking all his patients as on their deathbeds to pray rosaries for me.
So, obviously, it's become clear already that you're going to come back to the show many times, that you are going to be our house nun. But for the purposes of this episode, we are curious about the motherhood aspect of it. I mean, you told us before the show that you had always thought you'd be a mom, that you'd have children. And so has that been a struggle, giving up on that idea?
It has. It continues to be. I think I live 15, 12 hours away or something from my niece and nephew. So, you know, they're the closest thing I got to flesh and blood and, you know, that experience of descendants, which is just, it's so important. It's a human need in some ways, right? To have that. Yeah. So, and I have this great fear that like my niece and nephew aren't going to really know me, and I'm just going to be kind of like this blurry adult in their life. And I don't know how, to show them that I'm so devoted when they see me absent, you know, they don't see me, I'm absent to them. So it is, it's one of those things that I'm always sort of grappling and struggling with. And, but on the other hand, I guess I had a sense when I was probably in those college years when I was kind of, you know, coming into who I was, that like if I would have been a mother, it wouldn't have let me become my best self. And I just had this kind of like this imagination of like, well, I'm going to be sitting there trying to pray in the morning, and then there's going to be babies crawling all over me, and I will just be annoyed with the kids because I can't be talking to God. And like, that's not going to be good for anybody. So, it does seem like this lifestyle of not being a wife and a mother is like actually giving me the freedom to be my best self.
I think freedom is a really interesting word. And it's almost like you're free to do, I think what you describe as sort of like have a broader reach, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think if I would have become, you know, married, I probably would have ended up in a house with a mortgage and kind of like, really like, okay, honey, what are we going to do now? And just really, you know, versus this, the interdependency is with a much larger group of women who are much more free spirited and devoted to like serving people in the same way that I am. So they understand, oh yeah, you're called to now do this thing and go there. And so you have the freedom. Go ahead.
So here's a question though, kind of along these lines, you know, a couple of weeks ago, there was a pretty big scandal in the press when Paul Ryan fired the house chaplain, the Jesuit father, Patrick Conroy. And part of the mm-hmm. reason giving for the firing, obviously there was a lot of political, you know, backlash too, but part of the reason given is that a Jesuit priest cannot really minister to people with families not knowing what their particular challenges and, you know, needs are. When you kind of read that news, does that infuriate you? Does it make sense to you? How do you feel, in other words, your standing is with people who have life experiences that are so radically different?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And I would say that because I'm a minister and because people will sit down with me and kind of like pour out their hearts and their pains and, you know, their what they're struggling with, I'm able to kind of feel at times like I'm a mirror and I'm able to see into their lives differently than if I were experiencing it. So I when I heard that, you know, then there's a part of me that just really got defensive and feeling about like, what are they talking about? Don't they understand that like we might actually know more about marriage and family life
right.
by observing it and having our own families and the challenges of it? It's not like we're isolated and removed from the world, but we're actually serving a lot of people who are involved in the challenges all the time. So it's not like our nucleus is, you know, we're not just focused on our own little family. We're focused on, yeah.
Amen, sister.
And you're a youth minister, so I'm curious what the experience is. I mean, it's obviously important to you to work with young people.
Yeah. I always wanted to be a teacher, so that's still part of it for me. And I mean, I was an education major, and you know, that's kind of my background. And so, I don't know. I struggle with, like, am I really a youth minister? I don't really know if that should be on my bio because I don't, like, versus when I was teaching high school, I had a steady group of kids that I had relationships with. And now it's more like I'm in and out of these kids' lives. I will say, though, that they do seem to be receptive of me because they've never met anyone like me before. And they probably have all these stereotypes about what sisters are or aren't. And then they meet me and they're like, oh, maybe that's actually something I could do. So that's kind of nice.
Mm-hmm. You're a cool sister. You're not a regular sister.
All right. So listen, Sister Julia, one of the privileges that you get as Gentile of the Week is the opportunity to ask questions of an internationally recognized panel of Jewish experts as certified by iTunes. So do you have any questions for us? Anything you've wondered about Jews or Judaism that we can help you with?
Yeah, I do. I have a thousand, but I'm just going to ask a really silly question, but it's something I wonder about all the time. Do you guys get really sad that you can't eat bacon?
Okay, well, only one of us here doesn't eat bacon, because only more observant Jews who keep...
Two of us.
Oh, okay, but you're a vegetarian. You're not kosher.
I am vegetarian, but also I had started keeping kosher before I became a vegetarian.
So basically, Sister Julia, like, there are a lot of Jews who don't eat bacon, who don't eat pork because they keep kosher. And then there are some Jews who just, like, for whom they'll eat shellfish, but bacon and pork is just, like, a bridge too far. But a lot of Jews... who are more secular, who don't observe the laws of kashrut, they do eat bacon. And like, I eat bacon, and I love it so much. And now I'm talking about it, I feel a little guilty. But it's like, it is the forbidden fruit, right? Like, we are all sorts of torn up about bacon.
I think 80% of American Jews, 90% eat bacon.
Sister Julia, if I may confess, right, that I think that's the appropriate thing to do. I went kosher.
I can't absolve you, though.
Right. Nuns actually can't absolve. But go
that's
ahead.
Fine.
Go ahead.
I'm not asking for absolution. I'm asking...
We just want to talk.
You just want to bare your soul.
In the spirit
of
kind of ecumenical love. So I went kosher about a year ago now. I will be very honest and say that not a freaking day goes by that I don't think about bacon at least part of the time. In fact...
That's hilarious.
Given... Yeah, not so much for me. But given the choice between giving up, you know, carnal relations or bacon, you know, really
yeah.
tough call. If I could choose, like, do you want to go this or that?
There's actually a religion that will let you be pious by giving up carnal relations, but keeping bacon, Liel.
So I hear. But I will say that there is a sense, I almost feel like our, you know, like the wise rabbis made such a great decision. They're like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take the absolutely, incontrovertibly greatest, most delicious, most appetizing foodstuff humankind has ever created, and we're going to make it completely forbidden. So every time you smell that heavenly smell wafting from some kitchen, you're going to have to stop and remind yourself mindfully that you have a higher calling. And that you do not succumb to your earthly base needs. I genuinely love that. I love those moments of daily transcendence.
Sister Julia Walsh, we'll see you when we crash your convent in northern Wisconsin. That'll be us.
I can't wait.
At 2 a.m. throwing stones at your window.
We will come to teach the Judaism section in your youth ministry. Be like, and so we have 3 live Jews, and they'll tell you everything you want to know.
Thanks for being our Gentile of the Week.
Yeah, my pleasure. God bless you all.
Oh, you too. Bye-bye.
Shalom.
Mailbox. We have a lot of letters in the queue that we're going to get to next week, because this week is chock full of stuff. But I wanted to put out a request for some stuff. We love hearing from you. We hear from you a lot. I wanted to remind you that we are doing now a regular column at tabletmag.com called Ask Unorthodox, where we're answering all your questions. You know, sometimes we do a special episode of the podcast, but we're also doing a weekly column where we're giving you etiquette tips. We will give you advice about your in-laws. We will give you rabbinic rulings. We will give you permission to, eat something that your rabbi won't. We will tell you which camp to send your kid to. We will give you fashion advice. Send us your questions, unorthodox@tabletmag.com, and maybe in the subject line put Ask Unorthodox. You can also call us at 914-570-4869. Also, I want you to settle a little debate we've been having. On the Facebook group this week, there was a really, really interesting thread where somebody posted something about a time that one of us had interrupted Stephanie in an episode, and it basically very quickly got into the question of interrupting. And the question at hand seemed to be, is interrupting always, or is it often a form of gender dynamics at play? Is it a power imbalance? Is it inherently mansplaining, or men exercising or performing their privilege privileged role when they interrupt. And I, who try to be very sensitive to these questions of gender dynamics, actually pushed back. And I said, one of the things you have to understand is that, as has been shown by the linguist Deborah Tannen, Jews are more likely to interrupt whether male or female. Cooperative overlapping was her term for it. That the idea that you
cooperative start... Cooperative overlapping.
Yeah, this is like something she's written about, and you can find her article, Google it. Like she's a serious, serious linguist. She's done the most important work on the differences in how men and women tend to talk and converse with each other and the gender differences, but also religious differences, which is there is something called cultural in certain Ashkenazi Jewish communities, and I think many of us have been exposed to it, where interrupting is not seen as necessarily rude. It's seen as engaged, right? That you don't wait for someone to finish what they're saying, stop, pause, and then say, well, that was interesting. Here's my opinion. Instead, you come in as they seem to be finishing right. or as they've made their point. And this is something that you see in all sorts of families. It's not
this is what passion is like.
This is what passion is.
This is what actual engagement is like.
Actual
life is like.
Actual discussion, actual argument. And by the way, what Deborah Tannen found is that in Jewish culture, as again, Ashkenazi Jewish culture of a certain kind, women do it as well as men. That it's not necessarily a gendered or highly gendered thing. That women do it with each other. That women do it with their sons, with their husbands, and vice versa. So I pushed back on the Facebook thread and I said, wait a second, if we really want to enforce a regime where nobody interrupts, that is actually kind of hostile to certain aspects of our cultural heritage, that might be fine at, you know, I'm going to stereotype here, at like Episcopal Church on the Green in, you know, Greenville, South Carolina or Concord, Massachusetts. But that actually, if you step into a highly Jewish community and say, don't interrupt, what you're saying is don't be as Jewish in a way that some of you were raised to be
Jewish.
Don't
be you.
Don't be you. So I had a problem with that. But listen, maybe the answer is, well, times have changed and that aspect of Jewish culture has to change. I don't know. The thing is, I want to hear from the listeners. I want like a massive influx of points of view on this. We will revisit it on a later show. Write to us, unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Put interrupting in the subject line.
Just interrupt us. Don't even write it. Call us.
Or call us at 914-570-4869. You both could get on the line and you could interrupt each other for the call. Try to keep it to a minute or under. And we will revisit this on a later show. Mazel tovs. Leo, what do you have?
As we record, a war is brewing, a war for the hearts and minds of the people of this planet, also known as the Eurovision Song Contest, which I've discussed at great length on this
and maybe
program.
Maybe too much length.
Yeah. Nobody knows anything about this in this country, but for much of the rest of the world, it is a very big deal. Okay. So in a few hours, we're recording, it's Tuesday morning now, at I think 3 p.m. Eastern time.
Right. So just as Trump is telling us whether he pulls out the Iran
Trump
deal.
Trump is discussing the Iran deal.
Something of equal geopolitical significance
absolutely.
Will be happening.
Netta Barzilai will take the stage to perform her, what I firmly believe, the winning song
toy?
This year, Toy.
I'm not your toy.
Netta, Batzlacha, Mazal Tov.
Okay, Stephanie Butnick.
I got a Mazal Tov for all the mamas in my life, in your life, in everyone's life, and also the people who have lost their mothers and for whom Mother's Day is a difficult day. And we are thinking of you, and we are sending you love, and, you know, that's it. That's all I got.
Josh Cross, our producer, has a Mazal Tov for his mama, Jill. Jill Cross? That is such a Gentile name. That's like Sister Jill Cross. Sister Jill of the Cross.
What a badass name.
That is a badass.
She is in the Facebook group, so you can just say this
Jewish
directly to
name.
Her.
Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers, including my wife, my sister-in-law, my other sister-in-law, my mother, and also a happy birthday to my mother. She's an early May birthday, as is my brother Daniel, so happy birthdays to them. And a farewell on a sadder note, a farewell to Rabbi Aaron Pankin, who was the head of Hebrew Union College, the Reform Seminary with campuses in Jerusalem, Cincinnati, LA, and New York. I was really quite moved by the testimonials I saw to the good work he'd done from rabbis who didn't necessarily get along with each other and were from very different kinds of worlds. Like my Facebook feed has a lot of rabbis, some of whom are fairly traditionalist, some of whom are very liberal. Reform is a very big tent, and a lot of people who don't necessarily see eye to eye on things, said he was a real tzaddik, a really wonderful man and a mentor and a great teacher. And so our big hug and love and condolences to the family, to the messengers and all the other people in the greater Penkin Mishpucha. A few final bits of business. We want to remind you that Ruby Namdar will be on our show in June to talk about his wonderful novel, The Ruined House. Last chance to call into our listener line and tell a conversion story. And finally, just a reminder that one of the great ways that you can help us is by posting an iTunes review like this one. Let me read this one aloud. It says, Nish Nish Tumish Mush. I'm not your typical unorthodox listener. Hailing from a deeply religious family where Shlomo was really my brother and Ta'anit Esther was a serious holiday, I never thought I'd miss the daily rigmarole of serious religious observance. Unorthodox has taken the place of organized religion. Every Thursday morning, I run faster on the treadmill because unorthodox is getting me there. Yours truly, a Northeastern Jewess currently enjoying some delicious falafel at Nishnush. 5 stars.
I love that so much.
So basically, she left her family's traditional Judaism and replaced it with us and takes us to the treadmill and eats falafel.
Shalom.
Shalom Aleichem.
Run, Jewess, run.
Jewess, run. We will be sending you, send us an email with your address. We will be sending you a laptop sticker. Guys, let's try to one-up each other. I mean, come on. That's pretty good, but I think some of you can do better. And the iTunes ratings really do help us get in front of other listeners who would enjoy the show. Thank you so much for your support. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or give us a voicemail, 914-570-4869. We often come to you live. For example, recent guest Jenna Weissman Joselit, who's also a Tablet columnist, will be discussing her book on the Ten Commandments at New York's Congregation Rodef Sholem at 7 p.m. on Monday, May 14th. Tickets are free. I myself will be at Greenwich Reform Synagogue on Friday, May 18th. Stephanie will be moderating the next installment of the Jewish Book Council's Unpacking the Book discussion series at the Jewish Museum on June 14th. To book any of us, email producer Josh Cross at jcross@tabletmag.com. Of course, you also need to wear Unorthodox in addition to seeing us live. Go to bit.ly/unorthoshirt and find the latest in Unorthodox shirts, mugs, and stickers to put on yourself and around your coffee. Follow us on Instagram @UnorthodoxPodcast and on Twitter @Unorthodox_pod. Follow Stephanie Butnick on Instagram @SButnick. Join our Facebook group. If you do one thing today for the world, for humanity, join the Facebook group. Our show is produced by Josh Cross and Shira Talushkin with help from Julia Frakes. It's edited by Noah Levinson. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our intern for a few weeks more is the splendid Theo Cantor. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision this week by Rabbi Michael Zedek, Emeritus Rabbi of Congregation Emmanuel in Chicago. Dig a little deeper, you'll find out he is the rabbi to the band Wilco. Just ask if you have any questions about that. If you think your rabbi should be selected to offer rabbinic supervision, write to me at moppenheimer@tabletmag.com, and we'll see what we can do. We record at Argo Studios, which is so excited to have Oliver North to kick around again, and we are proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.